And welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz of the Legions of the Slightly Damp, who have just rolled into the building, but drying out as
is
we speak.
It's raining outside.
Oh, it's buckets, man. Buckets.
In the summer.
Take your umbrella. That's our weather report. Just grab an umbrella and take it.
Oh, I'm sure they're complaining at the news station. Complain
it's the best news. This is live, folks. Get your umbrellas out.
This will be useful when we rerun Monday at 6 a.m.
Yeah.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen, and you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast on Podbean, iTunes, and or the Stitcher. Today, we are going to talk about the end of the Chronicle Herald strike out there in Halifax. Was it 550 days and 19 months too late? We will talk about that. And then we will try our best to cover everything that's happened in regards to President Trump, Nazism, and the blowback against the alt-right and Confederate statues and monuments that happened last week, starting with the events in Charlottesville almost a week ago. That should be a fun 25 minutes, and will undoubtedly go by pretty fast. But first, we're going to address some provincial news, and to help us with that, we have a guest joining us by phone. His name is Thomas Mooney, and he was standing as a candidate or as a nominee to be the Progressive Conservative candidate for Guelph in next spring's provincial election. He has since stepped down, and we're going to talk to him about that. Thomas, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for joining us. To begin with, let's set this up. There have been a number of instances of, I don't want to, say, it's written in stone that this has happened, but there have been some accusations in various writings around the province at Progressive Conservative Writing Associations that there has been maybe, let's call it chicanery, the wishes of people in that riding in selecting their nominee have perhaps not been represented. So can you talk a bit about that and perhaps why that forced you to make a decision that you cannot stand as a potential PC candidate in next year's election?
Certainly. I just want to be clear in all of the big parties. Mm-hmm. This is an option that each party has, management has, to be able to select their own candidate outside of local nomination processes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where my issue with that is when you do have candidates, and there's other candidates other than myself that had put their names into the hat, and from what I've seen from the people that I've spoken to that were other nominees, there was good candidates there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the local nomination process is for the people of Guelph to be able to come together and talk to each nominee, get an opportunity to hear what they're about, what they stand for, and what they believe that they will move forward with and bring representation to Queen's Park for your local riding.
Right.
And that right there is the very basis of democracy. And now, if there was no potential nominees in this area,
mm-hmm.
then I would be 100% behind the party finding somebody that would be willing to represent the local area. Absolutely. But when you've got people that are standing up, putting all of their efforts towards going through this procedure, then why are they tossing them aside?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I'm really raising the question. I'm not saying that I would have been the best candidate.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I would have put the absolute best forward for the people of Guelph. And it raises me in question of, why are you tossing good people aside
mm-hmm.
to put somebody else in before you even know what those people are about?
Just to clarify, are you saying that you felt particular pressure from the party on a local level that the party was perhaps leaning towards one candidate and perhaps it wasn't you, or are you talking more generally in terms of what's been happening in these other ridings?
All of it. Quite simply, there was no pressure on me at all.
Okay.
And people need to understand that. There was no pressure. I was not contacted by the party asking me to step aside, step down. But there was another nominee who was.
Right.
And that was one of the final straws for me, mm-hmm. is I saw him as a viable candidate for Guelph. I met the man, we briefly spoke, and I had hoped to be able to sit down with him and discuss the whole candidacy idea. And in my hopes were, in sitting down with him, we found that he was a better potential nominee. I would be happy to get behind him and go all the way through to the election.
Mm-hmm.
And the other third person, if they were, I would have gotten behind them as well.
Mm-hmm.
My number one goal is Guelph needs good representation at Queen's Park. People are going to stand up for Guelph and the province as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
But when that's taken away, I really have to question, with the toe the party line whole idea, is are we going to be getting somebody that has headquarters at best at heart or Guelph?
Right.
And I tend to think it's the latter.
Right. And we have had some controversy with that. There have been previous candidates on the federal level for the Conservative Party who people have had doubts about where their loyalties lie, whether it's to the riding or whether it's to the leader's office.
Absolutely. No, you need to understand that this isn't just a Conservative thing.
Right.
My whole point is this goes right across both ends of the spectrum politically.
Mm-hmm.
The Liberals have been having issues with this.
Mm-hmm.
There's charges that are they're having to deal with.
Yeah.
So it's not just the Conservative vote that's being affected here. It's the entire government system of election.
You're of course referring to
violate the democracy.
Right.
We're on the losing end of that.
Right. You're, of course, referring to the Sudbury by-election in which there's actually a trial coming this fall about whether or not there was impropriety involving the Premier's office. Let me ask you this. You were coming up on an election where there's an incumbent government that's been in power for 15 years. It is, you know, it's not partisan to say it's fairly unpopular. There's fairly, you know, wide partisan support that the Liberals are tired, perhaps need to be voted out. And I think that you would agree the Conservatives, being the official opposition right now, probably stand the best chance of forming a government in the next election. So it seems like the world is the PC's oyster at the moment, or at least the province is the PC's oyster. There should be a great time to be coming on to the PC brand and making points and carrying on through the spring. And it seems like, you know, even though this is a couple of ridings, it does seem to have poisoned the well a bit. You know, is there any insight you have in terms of why the party is sort of struggling internally at a time when they should be riding high?
Here's my personal view on this, is that the poison well that you're referring to,
mm-hmm.
it's been done many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And people have become complacent in that's just the way it is. Well, no, that's not the way our democracy is supposed to be. There are good people within the Conservative Party, and there are people, some of those good people, they're walking, they're leaving, they're stepping out of it because they have the similar beliefs that I have, that the whole system of you do as I say is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You hear over the years people been talking about, you know, we would like to be able to have the option of recall if something goes wrong.
Right.
Well, you know, if we had the possibility for our local representative to have the free vote, not going by the toe of the party line concept, but have a free vote, if our leader is going down the wrong path, then our local representative can vote looking after our best interests.
Right.
But right now, with the toe-the-party-line idea on all of these parties, we don't have that option.
Right.
So what I'm, my whole point is, we need to get back to a democratic method of electing our leaders, mm-hmm. and stop electing dictators.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a situation where we vote to defeat a government.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be better to vote to get a good government in?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm behind. I will be voting conservative again come next spring,
mm-hmm.
but I don't believe, unless the PC party can get their bootstraps together, I don't believe that they will be the where my vote goes.
So, Thomas, it was mentioned in one report that you had considered possibly running for another conservative party, but from what you said, if you're voting conservative in this spring or next year, that's probably not going to happen now. Or you're still mulling it over?
I haven't decided what I'm going to do. I have been approached by a couple others, other parties, some new up-and-coming parties as well that are conservative, but they're open-minded conservative.
So not
they
the
allow
pirate
that
party.
Free vote.
You're
I'm
keeping your options.
That right now, I've got a bad taste in my mouth, and I've really got to sit back, let my heels cool before I make that decision again.
Do you think there's going to be a lot of people like you who may end up, you know, I hate the expression, but hold their nose and vote PC because the idea of another 4 years of Kathleen Wynne is intolerable?
That's been thrown at me, and it's been suggested that I'm going to be tainting the vote by splitting the vote.
Mm-hmm.
But here's where my perspective on that is I am conservative. I will vote conservative.
Right.
If we end up with a minority government with the PCs in power and the other number of people that have on the outside that are still conservative do get seats, then there's a good potential chance that things will start getting back on track, mm-hmm. because the free vote is more important than a dictatorship.
Mm-hmm. You seem to indicate this was a systemic problem. So is there anything that Patrick Brown himself can do?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Give the power back to the local riding associations to be electing their representatives.
Mm-hmm.
Consider yourself, if you're, and I'm hypothetical situation here, you're needing representation for, let's say, a court matter.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to be able to select the lawyer that's best for you, or some stranger that you don't know that lives in the next town is going to tell you, no, this is who's going to represent you. Mm-hmm. You don't know that person from Adam.
Mm.
Do you know for certain that they're going to represent you 100%?
Right.
So that's what it comes down to, is here in Guelph, I'm just, because we're here, and I'm part of Guelph, mm-hmm. I could put any city's name in there. You can go to any town and say, okay, who in town here would be good to represent us?
Right.
Small towns, like, Guelph is not a small town. It's a good-sized city,
mm-hmm.
I like it here. And there's a lot of people here that would be great representatives. And you get to know the people of your town. But when you're going, and what I refer to the star candidates,
mm-hmm.
From wherever they're going to be pulling them, and they might be a Guelphite,
mm-hmm.
and they might be a great opportunity. But do we know that for sure?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we don't know that until all of a sudden, the last minute, boom, here it is. And that person hasn't been vetted by the community.
So what happens, or what prompts Patrick Brown to give back that power? Because, you know, it would seem that having a caucus full of people who are passionate about their communities would be the ideal, more than, you know, sort of dropping people in and I guess playing strategic with the electoral process.
I don't know what is in Patrick Brown's mind that way. All I can say is It seems to be the focus now is more about having the power to defeat than to be creating a good representative government option.
Mm-hmm.
And now, and as I said before, that's not just a problem within the PC Party of Ontario. That's in the same problem with the Liberal Party. And as I've said before, I'm not too sure about NDP. We don't hear much about what's happening there. Somebody else could answer that question. But what the bottom line is we need people that are going to be looking out for us and considering the rest of the province as well, not looking out for headquarters and then everything else follows.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my perspective on it. You give the vote back to the local people, I will stand up and say, great. I'll shake his hand and say, Patrick Brown, that was a good move. But as long as we're going to be continuously in this pattern of electing dictators, then we've got a problem in our system.
Mm-hmm. Well, Thomas, we really appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk to us by phone about your thoughts and the issues. And if you do end up deciding to run, we will be more than happy to have you on to talk about the issues wherever you hang your flag.
Thank you very much. And in closing, I'd like to just say is to anybody, really start doing the research now on who you want, what kind of representation you want.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's more important than which party.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much.
Great. Great point. Thank you, Thomas. Thank you again. And that was Thomas Mooney, a local man who was going to be running for the PC candidacy here in Guelph, has opted not to because of the things going on in Carleton Nepean and Hamilton West, Ancaster Dundas, which is a mouthful, and Ottawa West Nepean and Newmarket Aurora. And
seems to be a bit of a pattern, doesn't it?
It's a little bit of a pattern. Wow. I actually wrote a brief article about it on Politico that you can find, which has links to the relevant stories if you want to go deeper on that issue. And it did sound like Thomas Mooney's message was to go deeper. So by all means, that's a good place to start, and not just because it's my own website. Speaking of websites, wow, awesome segue. The Chronicle Herald is back in business with a full-time journalistic staff. We've talked about this a couple of times as you know, sort of news has broken on it. The staff of the Chronicle Herald, which is in Halifax, which is the largest independent paper, oldest and largest independent paper of its kind left in Canada, was on the workers there, about 61 to start with, strike for 500 days, started on January 23rd, 2016. It finally ended last week with a new deal with the Halifax Typographical Union, which is a name that desperately needs to be updated, but that's neither here nor there. But so 61 people went out on strike. 52 people were there to ratify the agreement when it was over. 26 of those people still have jobs. So this is a terribly bizarre case, and I will yield to the representative of the old labor show to talk about the finer points. But you know, it's not usual where you hear somebody reaching a settlement, a mediated settlement at that, where they are where they give up pay and more working hours in exchange for fewer jobs and sort of basically a revamped news and having to go back to work. And you'll definitely have some strong thoughts about this, but going back to work next to some of the people that replaced them.
Yeah, it's always tough. I mean, this is one of those worst case scenario things considering how long it went on, but it was ratified with 94%, which is really, really high. So I think they'd finally come to, you know, the time had come for them to say, look, we really need to end this now with whatever is left. They, you know, after that long, 19 months. I mean, you rarely hear about a 19-month strike now. Occasionally, it'd be like a company would hang in on strike, and then usually they would just disappear. And I think the thing is with the newspapers and such, media, that you can't just up stakes and go to wherever because you need to be in your market, let's say, and some significant changes too. I mean, this, and we've talked about this in the past about, you know, the survival of media, and in particular print media, which is pretty much, and I hate to say it because I love the papers, I've said this before, but it's on its last legs. It really is. I mean, anything, they can't give newspapers away. Now, I picked up a Toronto Star on the weekend, the whole thing, the Saturday Star, was just free. It's like, here, take these papers. We can't sell them. and yeah, you know, let's be honest about it. And I guess, you know, the name harkening back to the olden days, the Typographical Union, they took the printer and threw it in the river. Like, that's how old-timey it sounds. But it is an old-timey media. Now, some of the examples, there's been some changes to people's job descriptions. There was, yeah. They specifically mentioned somebody who was a staff photographer now becomes a multimedia journalist.
Yeah.
So rather than have those, you know, your Peter Parker with your camera taking pictures, you're a multimedia journalist, which is a wide open job description. What is that? To me, that generally involves something to do with the internet, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what my son does, but he does something with the internet, like that kind of, right?
That's so, basically the job description.
Pretty much, too. And what was interesting, too, the paper that popped up by some of the workers, the Local Express, which seemed to be part of the Guelph Today family. The
Village is part of Village, yes. Media, which I am a columnist for the Guelph Today. I just want to throw that out there.
Yes, true. Was anything of yours in that paper? Or they pick it up?
I
no.
doubt it.
You never
my
know.
My stuff's pretty Guelph-centric. So.
Anyway, won't be able to check soon because it sounds like it's going to be pulled as part of the terms of the agreement.
Yeah.
It's just going to disappear, which in some ways I guess is too bad, but I guess if it's probably a non-compete kind of thing, you know, that you probably have this side paper if you still have a job.
From what I gather, they're negotiating to buy that content as well, so it might just go away. It might like zap and you might go to localexpress.ca and it might be gone, but on the other hand, it might be folded into the Chronicle Herald content, which wouldn't make some kind of sense because it was Chronicle Herald staff. It is sad because you think with half the newsroom cut, you know, that half might go, you know, instead of folding that up, giving that, or saying, you know what, if any Chronicle Herald staff wants to go work for Local Express and continue on and make that a thing, you know, it's kind of a consolation prize because with the Chronicle Herald kind of back in full business, that there might not be the economic incentive to keep up with Local Express, but who knows what they could do with it.
Yeah, and it sounds like they were looking for a non-compete clause as part of the negotiation. I don't know if that was what was part of the holdout. They don't usually say what the sticking points were once the settlement comes. It's like, well, we spent a year fighting over this or that. They generally don't. But it also sounds like their severance wasn't too bad. 2.5 weeks per year to 68-week maximum isn't too bad as far as severance goes. When we hear of places like Sears and other companies that leave and are left with nothing, that's actually not too bad. And maybe it was something like that was a bit of a tipping point too for the people that have been let go, that their severance, I mean, 68 weeks max, that's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on what, you know, what their pay scale and whatever was. But I mean, because a lot of times in a situation like this is nothing, there's nothing left, there's just the corpse.
Yeah.
And somebody buys it and does whatever. But generally, when it gets to this point in a strike like this, a media strike like this, they just fold. I mean, look at our own paper has gone, and there wasn't even a strike; it's just gone.
Yeah, it was just
so
cool.
Now Halifax, a larger market,
well,
obviously. But
speaking, I mean, that's an interesting date because I think that was the week they announced the Mercury was closing, January 23rd.
Oh, was the week of when the strike was announced?
Yeah. Well, yeah. The strike began the same week the closure of the Mercury was announced.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there's causation,
no, but
or correlation, but it was a weird week for local media
for sure.
Yeah. The scary part to me, and this was reported on Canada Land, was the people who are the scabs. That's maybe not a popular word, but
oh no, they're scabs. You say that in my presence, I don't know. It's
but
fairly accurate.
I mean, it's
strike breakers.
It's hard to tell people who are struggling to make money in the media industry now that it's wrong for them to do a thing where they're going to make a salary. So I mean, that's the sticky wicket of this. Going back to sticky wickets, but the Canada Land report was that the temporary staff, let's call them, at the Chronicle Herald, sure, were going to a website called All Nova Scotia, which is unique because it is like a secure paywall. You have to pay to read it. There's none of this 10 articles for free stuff. If you want to go to All Nova Scotia, you have to pay to access it. So apparently, somebody was paying to access it. basically copying and pasting content.
Oh.
And then sending it to city officials at the city of Halifax and saying, hey, can you guys look at this and, like, correct anything that's wrong? And then we'll throw that up online or put it in the paper.
It's pretty scabby. Yeah.
But, I mean, they don't...
And... I don't think ethical, really, either.
Yeah, but I mean, are any of those people going to be sticking around? Because those are the people who definitely shouldn't be sticking around. And I don't know if it speaks to the inexperience of those people or the fact that they were just, when the strike happened, they just started hiring people and didn't really check into their credentials or experience or looked at their clips or anything to see if this person had the capacity to hack it at a big city newspaper. But that's pretty bad. That's like epically, terribly, ethically wrong.
Sure, but I mean, that's generally what you get when you've got people filling the positions that aren't really trained for it. It could be whoever. It could have been,
yeah.
I'm not saying this actually happened, somebody's son needs a job.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Or whatever. It's like, here, I'll just do this. I'll just, everybody's copying and pasting. I'll just do that. I did that with all my essays. I'll do it here, too. So, yeah, a lot of the stuff.
You're not wrong. Like, HuffPost does it.
Yeah, well, yeah. But I mean,
Canada Press and CBC and stuff. But yeah, you know, yeah.
Because there was that time before HuffPost really had dedicated journalists, and now they're considered a respectable. Like, not that they were ever disrespectful, but that it initially started out as just a copy paste.
As an aggregator,
right?
But they still do that stuff.
Exactly. So, you know,
Althea Raj isn't writing that whole site, is what I'm saying.
No, but she does it to original content, right? And that's the thing. It's like, I'll just copy this. No one will notice, right? And then, of course,
Althea Raj isn't doing 200 posts a day, is what I'm saying.
No. And probably not even 200 tweets either. But so, yeah, the times are changing for stuff like this. And I don't know if we're going to see more strikes like this and of such duration too. I think it's going to be more along the lines of it's just gone. Mm-hmm. Like I'd mentioned before about getting the Star on the weekend. I really don't know how any daily newspaper, and even aside from the big guns, like say the New York Times, who have a massive online presence now and lots of people have signed up due to various things, including the Trump not liking them, among other things.
Right.
Believe that's going to be the future. So will we see let's revisit this in a year or something, see what the situation is at the Chronicle Herald, and, you know, have they headed more towards in that multimedia direction, which pretty much means no physical paper, right?
Well, that's one of the La Presse routes, one of the possibilities, mm-hmm. where there's no physical paper except on the Saturday.
Just a paywall.
I mean, we're obviously not going to solve this today, but right. It'd be interesting to come back in a year and see where they're at. Before we go to break, I wanted to send our condolences to a friend of the show, Charlie Angus, whose sister Kathleen passed away this week, and he's been sort of convalescing with her for a while as he's been taking a break from the leadership campaign trail for the NDP. Mm-hmm. So we want to send good wishes to him and his family in this difficult time. So we're thinking about him, and we're also going to be thinking, or have been thinking, about a young woman named Heather Heyer, who was tragically killed last Saturday at a, well, let's call it a fuster cluck in Charlottesville, Virginia, as white supremacist neo-Nazis and their ilk clashed with protesters who, let's say, think differently. And we're going to be talking all about that after the break. And we're going to go into some interesting different directions and not just what certain people might have said at certain press conferences. At least I hope. I can't predict where our conversation is going to go. But I know where we're going to go next, and that is to PSAs and a music break. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
So why don't you start wearing purple? Why don't you start wearing purple? Start wearing purple for me now!
That's an order. Start wearing purple. That was Gogol Bordello from their album Gypsy Punks, Underdog World Strike. And as you heard in the PSAs, Gogol Bordello are one of the headliners at Riverfest this weekend in Allura. They're coming to town. I can't believe it.
It's nice when everything comes together.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm wearing my purple tie today.
Yes.
It's even though I'm on the radio. That comes from... We were having a debate about this before the show, whether that's like the official color of anti-fascism or whether that, because it was said at the memorial service, everybody was wearing purple in honor of Heather Heyer, who was a 32-year-old woman, paralegal, who was killed by, allegedly, by James Alex Fields, 20-year-old from Ohio, whose teacher probably had the best descriptor of him. He was big into Nazis. This came in Charlottesville, Virginia. There was there's a big old statue of Robert E. Lee there sitting on a hill in a park. The city of Charlottesville was going to remove it, and some white supremacists did not like that one bit. They had this Unite the Right rally to I don't know, to save the statue, to, you know, stand up for white heritage or something or other. And in the ensuing clash between the alt-right and the people protesting the alt-right, Mr. Fields allegedly went for a little drive through a crowd of people, killing Ms. Heyer, injuring 19 others, and leaving a lot of people shocked, up to and including the rebel media's Faith Goldie.
Yeah, and that was interesting. I watched, Scan watched most of that, and I didn't realize that it ended with a point of impact. But Faith Goldie does this thing. Her routine is that she'll be, it's supposed to be news, and she'll be at an event or something. There was an example of her in, I guess it was in Jerusalem, and Muslims were praying, and she's like, look, see, it's along the lines of, they're taking over, right?
Right, well, that's
so
the message.
She was in this march and berating people the whole way, and it's like, look, these people can march unmolested, and yet the alt-right or whoever can't have their march, and they had the proper permits, blah, 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 blah. Boom, the car hits. And for a minute there, I think she found her humanity.
Oh, she was shell-shocked.
Yes, because she was like, we need a medic here. Like, I think she realized at that point that, like, this had just gotten serious. It wasn't I'm doing free speech in air quotes. It wasn't just people talking about stuff. It got deathly serious there. And what was, and I don't know if you saw, did you see the Vice report? That is some excellent journalism.
Oh, yeah. I watched it again before the show. I was watching it earlier this afternoon.
In terms of journalism, I think that is the best thing to come out of that, and just in terms of keeping people informed, because she really got embedded right in with these guys. And when you see, I'm surprised that there weren't more injuries, because the amount of artillery these guys were packing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's America in some ways. But it isn't just
scary.
Yeah, and it isn't just about free speech anymore when you are carrying that much artillery. I mean, that's you're ready for battle there. You're not just saying, I don't like this statue. And of course, as we saw with the incredibly weird, as far as I'm concerned, the Tiki Torch Parade with the guys dressed like Trump.
Yes,
and
thank you. Yes.
It wasn't like, you know, keep this statue. It was blood and soil, and Jews will not replace us.
Yeah,
like, you're not just saying that we want to keep this statue. That's a completely different message. So we went from, almost used the S-bomb, that, and then to the next day where the confrontations happened, and it was like you spent pretty much the whole weekend processing it on social media and that, and then of course Trump chimes in. I wasn't sure how much we were going to talk about that, but I mean, that was when it had already derailed. But like, talk about not helping at all.
Okay, well, there are many layers to the Trump thing. First of all, he comes out several. This is Donald Trump, who we saw today. If you haven't been watching the news, there was I haven't kept up on it since I got down to the UC here. Apparently they had arrested somebody, but it was in Barcelona today. Somebody plowed a van into a crowded tourist area.
I just saw it on the crawl. I didn't hear the whole story.
Yeah,
12 people?
There were a lot of people injured. I don't know how many killed. I can't remember off the top of my head because this kind of wasn't the point. But within 2 hours, Trump had posted, and it was a rather sort of sober for Trump tweet about, you know, our thoughts and prayers, et cetera, et cetera. 2 hours. But there was dead silence for hours and hours and hours on Saturday. And then he's coming out to sign this veterans thing. And he makes a statement. And it's I don't have it up, but, you know, to paraphrase, it's like, I hate this despicable violence, which everybody is perpetuating, basically. A lot of people thought that wasn't good enough. And then on Sunday morning, the White House issues a statement from some nameless press office person that, you know, said loud and clearly, we denounce white supremacy, Nazism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Although there was a typo in the first release that was said nephew Nazi instead of neo-Nazi.
Oh, no.
But
autocorrect, eh?
But, I mean, that's what happens when you're trying to do this stuff on the fly. Then he comes out Monday. And he starts off by talking about the economy, and then he goes into this prepared statement, which he reads word for word through gritted teeth about denouncing neo-Nazis and white supremacists and all that. Cut to, this was when he was at Trump Tower. Cut to, no, it's still at the White House. Cut to, later that day, he's making another statement, and as he's walking away, Jim Acosta of CNN starts yelling at him about you know, stronger denouncements, and are we going to have a press conference about this, because Trump had promised a press conference for Monday on Friday. He said, we're going to have a big press conference on Monday. And so everyone's like, oh, okay, he's going to take questions, and that's not what happened. And so Jim Acosta's like, what about that press conference? And Trump's like, we already had one. And Jim Acosta's like, well, you know, you kind of didn't, you know, why did it take you so long to denounce? Like, why did it take you so long to issue that statement? And he's like, oh, I'm not going to answer your question because you're fake news.
Yeah.
So he goes back to that meme. And then the next day is the big press conference, inadvertent. He wasn't supposed to take questions.
Talking about the economy or something else,
It was supposed to be the Secretary of... I don't think this is the right title, but the Secretary of Infrastructure,
yeah, yeah.
And then the Secretary of Transportation were supposed to take questions. But he stood there, took questions, and it became this free-for-all where he went back to the everybody's guilty meme.
Yeah. It was, well, some of the adjectives are this news conference, extraordinary, remarkable, astonishing. Like, I don't think anybody could just, again, another train wreck. Not completely surprising, because like, he did trot out some of the old, like, let me finish fake news. Like, he was
like...
I'm going to tell you this, you're fake news. But then, you know, at some point it's like there's good people on all sides. And
yes.
Then it's like everybody, there's bad people on all sides. Like it just went back and forth. And this is the problem. You can kind of tell when he's reading the prepared statement and then he freewheels. Like he takes the prepared statement, like he would read it and then he adds the little bit at the end, like the both sides. Like that's his way of doing like some kind of
the believe me's and
some kind of corrective
so
measure. And frankly, the truth, you know, like he adds the little modifier, I guess, at the end that tries to,
he freewheels.
And this is, that's where it falls apart. And it's like, okay, people are expecting him to, because the ex-presidents are coming out and saying no, everybody else is coming out and saying no, there is no moral equivalency is the phrase you probably heard about 100 times. If you were listening to any of this on the weekend, there isn't a moral equivalency in a situation like this, right? There just isn't.
No.
And I don't know what he's trying to get at when he's saying good people. I think maybe what he's trying to say is that not everybody in that march was a Nazi, but which isn't accurate.
No.
Completely. When you see it's the symbolism trotted out. I mean, if you're marching in a group and the swastika is there, if you're not a Nazi, you're pretty darn sympathetic to it. And then, of course, they have all these other weird symbols that they just made up. And it's like the 12 guys that follow the flag that came up with a symbol. Yeah, let's all meet here. And it's like,
there was a group that ripped off the Detroit Red Wings logo and put like a swastika on the wheel.
Lazy.
And, like, and Detroit Red Wings had
lost their minds.
Come out and go like, hey, do not like do that crap to our symbol.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. And if you're in a demonstration, if you're marching with a group and you look behind you and you see somebody carrying a Confederate flag and you see somebody else carrying a Nazi flag, if you're not saying to yourself, I got to get out of this group right now, you are, to borrow another phrase, Trump reference to the Trump administration, complicit. And to go back to Faith Goldie, who, had that extraordinary moment, and I'm glad she's safe, she wasn't hurt, but she posted this other video, and it's on The Rebel right now, where she goes, look, just because I happen to think there's white genocide going on, and just because I happen to think that Christian values should be put first, and just because I think there should be a one-state solution for Israel, it doesn't mean I'm a white supremacist.
Her Twitter feed has a little logo in it that's an iron cross. What are you telling people when you do that? It's not just her name and then that little whatever the heck symbol is. It looks like an ohm symbol that indicates that she's Christian as well, which is whatever, right? But the iron cross in that, and you've got crusaders as your logo, not your face.
Yeah.
Like, you are consciously or not, and I think it is a very conscious thing, telling people a certain thing. When you do that, it all counts. All these little symbols, whether they're made up or not, or whether people know what they are or not.
Yeah.
Same thing with, like, the brackets around the Jewish names. I mean, that means something, right?
Yeah.
So you can't do this whole on this. You can't have it both ways. Faith Goldie, you can't have it both ways. Anybody that's in this, there are sides.
Yeah.
There's no finessing it.
And that's why no matter what Trump said on Monday, and I listened to it, it means nothing. It meant nothing unless that was going to be followed by the announcement that he was firing Steve Bannon, Stephen Miller, and especially Sebastian Gorka and his wife, Catherine Gorka, who I didn't realize worked in the White House, but she does. Nobody really knows what Sebastian Gorka does in the White House, but everyone knows that he's part of this Order of Velez, which is a Hungarian fascist group, which had no small part in helping lead Hungarians into concentration camps.
Mm-hmm.
But he's an out and proud member of that. And it ticks me off when I see, like, Face the Nation or CNN or whatever, when they put him on TV as a White House spokesperson. It's like, you're putting a Nazi on TV. I don't care that he's in the – I mean, I care that he's in the White House, but I don't care that he's a White House spokesperson. If somebody says, we're going to give you our Nazi to talk about this issue, the responsibility of journalists is to say, no, we're not going to put the Nazi on TV, and he shouldn't be in the White House either. So I did learn that his wife, Catherine Gorka, first of all, somebody married this guy. Second of all, she works in the White House, too, which speaks to, again, nepotism problems in this White House. But she helped end $400,000 in grant money going to Life After Hate, which is this group that helps people out of, the life, so to speak. And this was something the Obama administration set up at the end of its tenure late last year. Seems kind of ironic now.
Yeah, and this is all part of that, let's get rid of all things, anything that Obama ever did must
be
bad. Right? Let's just get rid of it.
He had his black hands on everything.
Oh, that's not too far off, exactly. And interestingly, I saw part of a statement, or like a condensed statement of what Bannon was talking about, said, calling these guys clowns, calling the marchers clowns.
That was the interview he didn't know was on the record.
Ah, okay.
Because he called up this progressive journalist for this small progressive publication, and he starts talking to him, not realizing it was an interview or on the record.
Kind of like Scaramucci.
It is Scaramucci. It's like, who are these people who... And it's this one pointed out that Steve Bannon is media savvy enough to know when you talk to a reporter off the record, you preface it by saying, this is off the record, because you have to turn the reporter off. And I know this from my own background, is you turn the reporter off when you want to, and there are magic words to do that. So for Steve Bannon, who was the head of a media company, to not know the magic words and then act surprised that his comments were published. Speaking of Bannon, though, I do want to come back to Canada's Bannon. Maybe not. Ezra Levant.
Oh, yeah.
but, I mean, he's having a hard time of it. He's lost three primary contributors to The Rebel this week, including The Rebel co-founder, Brian Lilly. The statement from all of them is that, we've kind of, this is not going away we like. And Ezra Levant issued a company memo that when he first heard of the alt-right, he thought it meant insurgent or politically incorrect or grassroots or nationalistic. And it's like, well, yeah, it is all those things. It is insurgent. It is politically incorrect. It is grassroots. It is nationalistic. What did you think it was? And I think he was just chasing the clicks, and now it's kind of costing him, because you have people like John Robson, who you may not always agree with, but, he does have an opinion, and he does have a following. Barbara Kay. Isn't he something like Brian Lilly, who probably skirts a little bit closer to journalism than Ezra Levant himself does, and certainly closer than, I think, Faith Goldie or people like Lawrence Southern?
Yeah.
But Yeah, and then Press Progress did a thing where they addressed, they've discovered that 25% of the conservative caucus has been on the Rebel, up to and including Andrew Scheer, who's campaign manager for the conservative leadership, Hamish Marshall, what is on the board of directors for the Rebel. And I guess they managed to shame Andrew Scheer just enough that he said, like, for, what did he say?
Just announced that today.
As it is. He's not going to appear on the Rebel as it is. And that's a quote, as it is. So I don't know what that means, as it is.
Under the current regime. What was it, the current regime? I can't remember what he said.
Yeah, but this is Ezra Levant's baby. But he's already been on commander.
This is the thing. I mean, we know that there's a tie-in with the conservatives. That, you know, this the Rebel was born out of the remains of Sun News, which was you know, all conservative. I wouldn't say all conservatives, but most.
Conservative-ish.
Conservative people. One of the first to come out on the weekend and said, I'm never going on the Rebel again, was Michael Chong, another friend of the show. So maybe we'll probably have him back before the Rebel ever get a hold of him. So if you're listening, Michael, it's an open invitation.
Hey,
of course.
He looked like he had a good time here. So
he did.
I'll give that to you. So yeah, and they've been asking a ton of conservatives, like, you know, are you going on the Rebel again? This was the Press Progress article, and they had a tough time sort of wringing out of people whether or not they're going to do the Rebel anymore.
Yeah, because in the back of the mind they go, my base.
And apparently, Simon, I want to say, Scott Gilmore.
Oh yeah,
who's a contributor to McLean's? Mm-hmm. Had apparently had a dinner where with some conservative politicians, some of whom were Andrew Scheer's opponents in the conservative leadership campaign, and we can probably guess who was among them, who was at this dinner to talk about leaning the conservative party more to the center and less to the right. And I think
Ezra Levant's head exploded right now, right there. Or, I don't
know. But I mean, this is like a huge kick to him, because on the one hand, he has like he's losing like the sort of the center right people who believe that the media is overly left wing biased, and on the other hand, he's losing, you know, the far right people. He's losing the Lauren Southerns, who's trying to, you know, strike out on her own. Gavin McInnes announced today he was leaving. Effective immediately from the sound of it.
To start something even more radical than the Rebel, probably.
The leader of the Proud Boys is leaving the Rebel. So I'm not sure if the ground underneath Ezra is shrinking. That'll be something else that'll be interesting to watch. But yeah, it's going to be incredibly difficult now that someone has died at the hands of a neo-Nazi on American soil. Mm-hmm. For anyone to, we're going to see this. We saw this yesterday with Trump canceling his economic council, which was a lot of these CEOs who, probably swallowed hard, held their nose, and said yes, you know, because, and this is the thing too. Trump was elected partially because he's like this wicked awesome business ninja, but he can't keep the business people on side.
The team is gone. Yeah,
he sacrificed, you know, mm-hmm. the sort of one thing that's sort of holding on to centrist Republicans and slightly left of the right supporters, which is his business, supposed business acumen. Because I still don't believe he's a half the businessman he pretends. But. He sacrificed that basically to go in whole hog with the alt-right. And that's going to be enormously difficult for him going forward, mm-hmm. especially when the first person who left the council, Kenneth Fraser, the CEO of Merck Pharmaceuticals, instantly attacked on Twitter. Maybe now you can go and lower drug prices, jerk, or whatever he said.
Yeah, it was and it, sad. Yeah.
Not coincidentally, at least I don't think so, Kenneth Fraser was the one African-American CEO on his council. Maybe not the one, but the one that left, he was the, but he instantly attacks him. It takes him hours to attack the neo-Nazis, but instantaneously he's on the black CEO of that leaves his council.
Yeah, and this is the thing. Trump's like, I was watching it way closer than you people were.
Oh my goodness.
I was like, okay, you're watching so closely you backed away from Twitter, which is like your means of communication. You're like human Twitter. He's like the walking Twitter. Right?
He is the
walking Twitter. I like Twitter, but it's like there's that whole realm
right.
where it's just that the realm that's keeping Liz Sandals off of it, obviously, as she commented on, where it is this weird that it's become news. It is the news. It's a first. I don't know if it'd be the last, but, you know, your main means of communicating your presidential whatever It's your opinion mixed with trying to be presidential is 140 characters in your underwear at 3 a.m. It's unprecedented. And I don't think when he does these press conferences and that it can be undone. This is the problem, is that you're working within that model, and then you're given the stuff. The new press guy, what's his name again? Standing there with his arms crossed, his head down. He's got
Kelly.
Yeah, that OMG,
OMG
look on his face. He's like, oh man, I got this gig. And you know he's probably going to get smoked as well before too long, right? If this keeps spiraling.
There was so much put on him. It's like, oh, the general's in charge. He's going to rein Trump in. Clearly no one can. And if you're not going to listen to the four-star general, and he's going to be standing in the background, basically with his head in his hands. I mean, he wasn't that bad, but you could see the look in his face. He was like, OMG.
Yes. It's an unbelievable
get me
picture.
Out of
like,
here.
Like,
send me to Iraq. Send me back to Vietnam. Anything but this.
Head hanging down.
And I want to point out two more things. Trump tweeted this morning, speaking of tweets, about losing all the art and heritage of these statues. That's not the exact quote, but that was basically the point. It was about three tweets long, but he's talking about how it's despicable they're tearing down these statues because we're losing all this great art and heritage. Mother Jones posted a thing that they found in the book Lost Tycoon. Apparently, there were two Art Deco frescoes on this building, the Bonwit Teller building, which was built in 1929, but currently sitting on that site is Trump Tower.
Right.
And there were these two frescoes that the Metropolitan Museum of Art wanted to save. It would have cost Donald Trump $32,000, which he probably could have written off because it was a donation. But it would have cost 2 weeks of construction of demolition. So he had them destroyed.
Oh.
Even though there was interest in taking them. So that's how much Donald Trump cares about art. The second thing I want to point to, and I found this last night, Christopher Cartwell, who is, I guess, the main character in that Vice documentary.
Yes. Was weeping.
Yes, he released a second video because I don't think this has been confirmed at all, but apparently he is under the impression there was a warrant issued for his arrest, and he posted this video on YouTube basically crying about how he was scared and how he was freaking out about the police coming, about, you know, with the state of emergency and everything.
I watched part of it. I was like, oh boy, really?
But it's like, if you, after this, you can't put yourself in the shoes of the people who march with Black Lives Matter and the people who march against anti-Semitism, the people who saw those torches coming and were afraid, or of people who see police officers and are afraid because they know about Trayvon Martin and they know about all these people who have been victim of police brutality. So now, are you not now empathetic? And I saw this, the guy who organized this in that Vice video, John Kessler, and he was surrounded by people, and he like literally ran for his life.
Oh yeah.
At the end of that press conference,
if it wasn't for all those
Sunday
cops, he'd have been done.
And you mean to tell me that you don't know what it's like to be a Black person now or a Jewish person? Come on. You know, we kind of have to grow up.
And the statues are coming down, whether it's under cover of darkness or people pulling them down, they're coming down.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's,
tear them down.
I wish we had more time to talk about the significance of that.
On that note,
we got to call it a day. Just a programming note, we are having Marwan Tabara in next week. He's the MP of Kitchener South Hespeler. And we're trying to get some more people. It's tough because it's summertime and people are on vacation and things, but we'll have more updates. Open Source is Guelph.com, Open Source is Newswire on Facebook, at @OS_Guelph on Twitter. Find us on the podcast channel on Podbean, the Guelph Politicast channel. We are also on iTunes and Stitcher. You can find me at AdamADonaldson at Gmail or at GuelphPolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scott Hertz on Facebook, Scott Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at spannerbook.wordpress.com.
And you can stay tuned for DJ Sounds Good to Me. I think it's a repeat here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we will be back here in not such a hurry next week at 5 p.m. on Thursday. See you then. We'll be right back.